Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 4th of February 1923, three terrorist campaigns and a fortune teller. Not in this episode, for reasons of time, ignorance or sloth. The French occupation in the Ruhr is still going on, and now we've got a railway strike and railway sabotage. The French have responded, responded might be the wrong word, but they have, at the same time, expelled some recalcitrant officials, and they are refusing to allow coal to be exported from Ruhr to the rest of Germany. At least I think that's what's going on. At Lausanne, the talks between the Allies and the government of Turkey have broken up without agreement. The main bone of contention is the future of Mosul. The Turks think they should have it, and the British and the French disagree. There's been also a lot of attention given to the talks between the British and American government over British debt. In the First World War, the British wanted a lot of stuff from America and took out huge loans to fund this. And now the time has come to pay up. Now you may be asking, hang about, if they'd taken out the loan, surely they should be paying those off. Well, there was some sort of agreement which meant that Britain didn't have to pay anything until 1922, and Britain will struggle, because I think the rate at which these loans were taken out was about 4%, and the British have negotiated this down to 3% or thereabouts, which is a considerable reduction. And it looks as if agreement is going to be made, but it does demonstrate that why the whole matter of reparations was not just a Allied German business. It was also because there's so much money owed between the Allies. Britain is bankrupt in 1923, but and France and Italy are in an even worse state. Bankrupter, if you like. And of course they're expecting the Germans to pay up, so it's quite important that I think it's important that Britain pays its debts as a demonstration. And it also demonstrates, of course, that if Britain is having problems paying its debts, well, there's a good chance, and it needs forgiveness of some description, well, there's a good chance that Germany does need some forgiveness too. Anyway, that's an issue that I'm not covering. There's also I didn't cover this at the time, but a few months ago, someone sent the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police a box of poisoned chocolates and almost killed him. Anyway, they found someone and they've charged him and he's in court now. Last week, I mentioned that the Bavarian government had banned a National Socialist demonstration in Munich. Herr Hitler, the National Socialist leader, declared that the demonstration would be going ahead. This is from Tuesday, the 30th of January. Over 180,000 of Herr Hitler's fascist supporters attempted demonstrations here during the weekend. You'd have to say 180,000, if true. I mean, demonstration numbers are always a bit up in the air. But let's say it's 90,000. That's still a good number, especially of a city which nowadays has a population of about 3 million or so. Yeah, he's doing well. It goes on. In spite of the fact that the town was packed with troops and that the government had forbidden all public demonstrations, large bands of fascisti, with swastika standards and armed with revolvers and truncheons, marched through the streets last night. At the various meetings, Herr Hitler referred in particularly offensive terms to England and America, the cad, and declared that unless these countries intervened to prevent further French action in the Ruhr, the presence of British and American subjects in Bavaria would no longer be tolerated, sentiments that met with enthusiastic approval. A gang of Herr Hitler's stormtroops invaded the Regina Palace Hotel, ostensibly in search of Jews and foreigners. Interesting the mention of Jews. I haven't seen that yet, but obviously, well, that's part of the ideology. After posting guards at all doors and examining the price list. Why are they examining the price list? Who knows? Anyway, it goes on. They proceeded to terrorise the people dining in the grill room. The manager, who is himself a supporter of the fascist movement, prevented actual violence by his tactile... I'll say that again. The manager, who is himself a supporter of the fascist movement, prevented actual violence by his tactful handling of the situation. I think it is worth pointing out that Hitler would appear to be the only person doing this stuff at the moment. The only person who is building a large-scale movement with the power to confront the state effectively. And you would have to, you look at his movement and you look at Mussolini's movement, which I covered last year, and the fact that it is large, that it is disciplined, that it is violent, that it is able to confront the state, they're all similar. The main differences I can see are that Hitler's movement is largely a regional movement, and also that at the moment Germany is... Germany, because of the occupation of the Ruhr, needs unity. But otherwise, you'd have to say, well, if you're in Hitler's shoes, why not attempt a coup? There's a good chance you're going to succeed. It is never easy to predict the future, unless you're this guy. This is from Wednesday, the 31st of January. At Bow Street Police Court yesterday, before Mr. Graham Campbell, Arthur Edward Taper Drew Clifton, alias Zazra, 53, describing himself as a mail order trader of Alexander Road, St. John's Wood, was charged on a warrant. What does that mean? I did look it up, but even the whole of the internet does not seem to have an answer to that one. Anyway, was charged on a warrant with unlawfully professing to tell fortunes. Right. Well, so that was a crime, was it? I say, was it? I mean, is it still a crime? I don't know, I shouldn't think so. Anyway, it goes on. Mr. E.F. Lever appeared for the defendant, who pleaded guilty. Mr. Musket, for the Commissioner of Police, said that for the purpose of obtaining evidence in this case, Inspector Draper of Scotland Yard wrote to the defendant on December the 10th using the assumed name of Ali Obid Khan. The defendant had been conducting his operations principally by correspondence with colonials and natives in West Africa, Lagos and Nigeria. I hate to point out that Lagos is Nigeria and Nigeria is in West Africa. Anyway, it goes on. In reply to the inspector, the defendant wrote enclosing a pamphlet headed, "Let me read the sands of time for you," and a number of advertisements relating to such articles as mysterious bamboo sticks, 10 shillings, Indian fakir's crystals for developing the faculty of clairvoyance, 10 shillings to 25 shillings. Inspector Draper replied by forwarding 15 shillings for a sketch delineation of the future. He filled in a coupon which required such details as date of birth, time of birth, if known, sex, occupation, and rank. In due course, he received a packet of 12 or 13 pages of closely typed matter, which Mr. Musket described as a farrago of nonsense from beginning to end. The Nigerian authorities had tried to get the police here to put a stop to his business, as they considered that a great imposition was being practiced on the natives. But owing to the different names and addresses used by the defendant, the police had been unable to take action before. It goes on. He ordered him, he being the judge, he ordered him to pay a fine of £25 and £10 10 shillings costs, or undergo 3 months imprisonment. That is about 7 ounces of gold. So, O libertarian, should this be illegal, or should white people living in St. John's Wood be able to fleece uneducated natives in Nigeria? Well, I would have to say I think this is a free speech matter, but it's not difficult to see why this sort of practice might become illegal. I think the best argument I can come up with is that criminalizing activity like this is likely to lead to unintended and unknowable consequences. In Ireland, the Civil War has entered a new phase. This is from Wednesday, the 31st of January. The campaign of destruction reached its highest point since July in Dublin City and County last night. Numerous heavy explosions kept the people in a state of lively apprehension from about 8:30 onwards, and several beautiful residences were destroyed. The first attack was made on the house of Mr. M. A. Corrigan, Chief State Solicitor of the Free State, in Leinster Road, Rathmines. His house, which stands in its own grounds, was visited shortly after 9 o'clock by a party of young men who ordered Mrs. Corrigan to leave it within 2 minutes. Fortunately, her husband was not at home at the time. Mrs. Corrigan's two little children were in bed, and with the help of her two maids, she removed them in their nightclothes to a neighbour's house. Meanwhile, the raiders had placed a powerful landmine in the basement of the house, and they exploded it just as Mrs. Corrigan and her children had reached a place of safety. The house was demolished completely. The Times then goes on to list 5 other such incidents. Now, part of this is a campaign of terrorism, for sure, part of winning the Irish Civil War. But there's also another element. An awful lot of big houses, as they tend to get called, were destroyed in this part of Irish history. I can only assume that this was a way of destroying the English presence, the British presence in Ireland. The irregulars, as they are known, are not the only people who claim a right to use physical force. This is from Monday, the 29th of January. 7 years ago, a band of 34 men set up a fiery cross on the summit of a mountain overlooking Atlanta, Georgia, and garbed in white robes and peaked hoods, concealing all but their eyes, swore fantastic and complicated oaths. So was the Ku Klux Klan reborn. Ah, reborn, eh? It goes on. The leader of the band was William J. Simmons, Colonel Simmons by grace of Southern courtesy, a former Methodist minister. They made him Imperial Wizard. He was a strenuous supporter of the doctrine of goodness by force. I'm not quite sure here if the New York correspondent of the Times is just taking the mick, or that's a serious philosophical force. I guess it could only be related to Jean-Jacques Rousseau's idea of people having to be forced to be free. But I don't think I've heard of that one before. Anyway, it goes on. With great energy, he set to work to build up his organization. Within a week, he had secured a charter for the Klan from the Superior Court of Fulton County. Its purpose, the court was told, was to inculcate the sacred principles of chivalry, the development of character, the protection of the home, the chastity of womanhood, and patriotism. Not much to argue with there. It goes on. And to maintain white supremacy. Ah. There was no mention of the maintenance of Protestantism. That was to come later. The Klan has probably 1 million members, 3/4 of them in the southern states. It claims a membership of 160 in the halls of Congress. There is no reason to believe that as an order it advocates violence to attain the object set forth in its charter application. What has happened to it is just what happened to the original order. It has got out of the control of its founders. The original Ku Klux Klan sprang from the night patrols of slavery times, when Southern gentlemen by turns policed the roads and severely whipped all Negroes found abroad after nightfall without passes. After the war, a number of Confederate Army officers met in Nashville, Tennessee, and formed the Order. It was meant merely to terrorize Negroes and carpetbaggers from the North, would-be evildoers. There was no thought of violence. Commercialism has been given as the explanation of the recent statement of the Imperial Wizard Simmons that the order is about to be extended to Europe, and that the ban against Roman Catholics has been removed. Every new member brings in $10, besides the profit on regalia. What was that saying about all movements starting idealistically and ending up as a racket? Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.